With us today. A lot of you responded to the show that we broadcast yesterday from Athens, from the University of Georgia campus. Greg Bluestein's with us today, and of course, Greg, you were with us for the show that we recorded Monday night. And we had a great time in Athens. The Athens crowds were so welcoming. They love you and Galloway.
It was so much fun. That's my second home. I went to school there, of course. So did Jim. And it was great being back, and they had a really great crowd, and I got to speak to some classes on Tuesday. It was a blast.
Yeah. Galloway and Bluestein, heroes of the journalism school at UGA. If you're watching us on Facebook Live right now, you know that we're back in Atlanta. We're continuing to come to you from our temporary studio while our talk studio is being rebuilt. So if it looks different, that's because it is. We're going to be in that new studio within the next couple of months, we think. Got a lot to talk about today. Tamar Hallerman, AJC political reporter in Washington, is with us. How are you today, Tamar?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're going to turn to you in just a minute after I introduce the panel. You have been busy. You've been filing like crazy, and we're going to talk about the several stories that you've been keeping track of. Before we get to that, as I said, Greg Bluestein is here. He is one of the political reporters at the AJC. You read him. I noticed on Sunday, Bluestein, you had not one but two byline stories on the front page of the paper. That ought to be illegal.
They keep us busy. And it was a very busy end of the legislative session, so we had a lot to write about.
Cesar Mitchell is back with us, former president of the Atlanta City Council. He ran for mayor a couple of years back. Cesar, we always enjoy having you here.
It's really great to be back.
And we have a first-timer, Jake Evans. He is the head of the Atlanta Young Republicans. He's the chair of the Georgia State Ethics Commission, and you're an attorney at Holland and Knight.
That's right. That's right. Good to be here, joined by my esteemed colleagues.
Yeah, and Jake, one more thing. You're the son of Randy Evans, one of the most contentious, difficult political leaders in the history of the state.
Just imagine being his son.
No, Randy's been on the show on any number of occasions. He's a great guy. He's been a he's been an active leader in the Georgia Republican Party.
And Jake is starting to rival him on CNN appearances.
Oh, terrific. Well, that's congratulations. Right. All right, we got a lot to talk with you about as well. Let's start, if we can't. Oh, but we should say, of course, what's interesting to me is your father was named ambassador to Luxembourg by President Trump, so he's over there living it up. And you haven't even gotten over there to visit
yet. I haven't. I've got to make time to do it. I've been so busy with law, and I was on the U.S. delegation to Taiwan, so I was there 2 weeks ago, so I've been more stuff than I can do.
Mara and I are pitching an enterprise story over there.
Sounds good to me. And while you're at it, you can go visit Jackie Cushman's dad, whose wife, Callista, is the ambassador to the Vatican.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Let's get going with topics for today. Tamar, you filed a major piece. It was on the front page of the AJC this morning, in which you talked with farmers. You really told some heartrending stories about farmers affected by Hurricane Michael in South Georgia, some of whom are selling off pieces of their land to try to stay above water. They're waiting and waiting and waiting for federal relief that does not appear to be heading their way anytime soon. Tell us about your story.
Yeah, sure. So I wanted to kind of put a human face to all of this gridlock in Washington. I've filed plenty of kind of incremental stories on all the fighting over Puerto Rico with Trump, Senator Schumer, all these kind of moving pieces. But I wanted to kind of capture what all this indecision in Washington was meaning for folks on the ground in Georgia. And for a lot of these farmers, you know, who some of them, like one farmer I talked to, Ken Hickey, down in Thomas County, 90% of his cotton, cotton yield was wiped out by the storm. So he mentioned he just mortgaged off a fourth piece of his family farm. And he said this was the last time he was doing it. If he doesn't have help in the next year, it's done. He's given up the farm, move on to something else after four generations of his family being there. So pretty powerful stuff, but it's not looking like the situation's any better up here in D.C.
Just to be clear, and, you know, anybody can weigh in if they want, what's happening with this bill, there is a measure to provide emergency relief for a number of communities across the country parts of states that have been affected by various natural disasters. The holdup has been that Democrats in the Senate have been demanding that Puerto Rico get the aid that they feel that the people of Puerto Rico deserve. The president has adamantly refused to do that, and so this whole thing has come to loggerheads. And before we bring in the panel, let's listen to what Georgia Representative Austin Scott said on the floor of the House about this impasse and the effect it's having on not just Georgia, but other states that have dealt with terrible weather situations.
For months, we've stressed the magnitude of the damage to our colleagues, and for months, we've promised this was a priority for the White House and congressional leadership from both sides of the aisle. Any bill to fund the government will have disaster relief. I don't know how many times I've heard it. I can't name all the people I heard it from. And as we stand here today, 6 months later, these can only be called empty promises. Never before have we seen American communities that were wrecked with the catastrophes neglected like this. Calls to White House staff have gone unheeded, and but for one tweet on April 1st, it seems the president has moved on. And then last week, the Senate showed how truly ugly and partisan politics have become, voting down a measure that would have brought billions in federal relief that communities in my home state of Georgia and around the country desperately need to get back on their feet again.
Tamara, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, I think both Republicans and Democrats can call out the other party on this one, and it's hard to know quite where to place the blame for this. We do know the president seems to have a personal animosity toward the government in Puerto Rico. He claims they're incompetent. He claims they are wasting money and doesn't want to send him another penny. But there's also been a personal feud back and forth between the president, the governor of Puerto Rico, the mayor of San Juan, and Democrats say they need especially food relief money there that the president doesn't want to give them. On the other hand, the Democrats don't seem to be willing to give up the Puerto Rican aid in favor of helping people here in their own states across the country. So there's blame to go around or no?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You see the president who, yeah, you have, I can't remember if it was the governor of Puerto Rico or the mayor of San Juan going on TV and saying he punched Trump in the throat. That probably doesn't help get the two sides closer to an agreement. At the same time, you know, you're right. There is money in this bill for things like California wildfires, which decimated portions of Southern California last summer. So that was with the expectation that Democrats from California would want to vote for this bill. But you know, the Democrats have done a really good job of staying unified on this. That's how they think they're going to get all this money. You have Republicans from Georgia claiming that Democrats have moved the goalposts a lot during these negotiations. They said they designed this bill to be bipartisan, that they were giving Democrats what they had asked for back in December, and then they say all of a sudden the Democrats want more. It's unclear to me exactly, you know, where that line is and what those private negotiations were back in December, but it looks like right now nobody's willing to let up. What was so remarkable about Austin Scott's speech, you know, he's from a deeply Republican district near Tifton. He's one of the first ones to, first of all, question the president and his commitment to the cause of helping farmers after Hurricane Michael. He's also the only Republican I know of who's gone on record being willing to give more money to Puerto Rico beyond what was in this Johnny Isaacson, David Perdue bill. So it'll be interesting to see. But right now, the House just left town for 2.5 weeks. So it's looking like it's going to be May by the time we get any revived negotiations.
All right, panel. Those of you here in the studio, weigh in. Caesar, you look like you're ready.
Well, you know, it's all about politics. And the closer we get to the presidential election, the more it'll be about politics. And I think it's you know, one of those situations where you've got both sides, you know, how do you say, cutting off your nose to spite your face? And I think at the end, both may lose. But I think both are making calculations based upon politics. I think for Democrats, I think, you know, Democrats have to be very careful here, because you're talking about disaster relief throughout the entire country in areas that need it, and what seems to be weighing in the balance whether or not there is more or incremental funding for Puerto Rico. The American public might not buy that and agree with that over time.
And look, in the summer, when Congress could come back, it's too late for a lot of farmers. Planting season's here. As Tamar said, they're having to mortgage off parts of their property. They're going to have to make tough decisions about what to plant, what to do ahead of this growing season. It's it's we're talking about generational damage. And what strikes me during this debate is this is a test of the Georgia delegation's clout in Washington. This is a singular priority. If you ask everyone from Senator Isaacs and Senator Perdue on down, it's if not their number one priority, it is right up there in top three. And yet, despite most of the delegation pulling together on this, it's still going nowhere in Washington. It doesn't matter how close Senator Perdue is with Donald Trump. It doesn't matter the bipartisan relations Senator Isaacson has built with across party lines. It's got to be so frustrating for Georgia lawmakers to just be stalling on this after what it's been 6 months, 7 months since this hurricane. And yet nothing's happened.
Jake.
Yeah. And for both Perdue and Isaacson, I mean, you're talking about their base. I mean, you're talking about rural Georgia. You're talking about farmers who are being disproportionately harmed outside of the city of Atlanta. But Caesar's right. I mean, the issues in D.C., which historically have not been split issues, are politicized. I mean, everything in some way or another is a political fight. Now it's coming down to Puerto Rico. And the reality is the president takes things personal. I think that the comments from the Puerto Rico leadership there, he's going to take to heart, and he believes in his heart of hearts that they're incompetent, they don't properly use money, and I think it's unlikely he backs down.
What did you think, Jake, as the leader of the Atlanta Young Republicans, when you heard Austin Scott actually call out the president on the floor? It was a tempered statement, but he also pointed out that broken promises have been aplenty. And he pointed out that the vice president actually visited the area, and they're still nowhere. So it was interesting to see how far he was willing to go in calling attention to the president and the vice president not getting this done.
Yeah, well, Representative Scott wants to get reelected, and he knows that he is in a very, very tenuous position because it is his electorate who is being harmed, and we're talking about real harm, as Tamara just said. I mean, these are individuals that are potentially going bankrupt. They're individuals that can't pay mortgages on their properties. And so he's in a difficult position because he's got Trump, who no doubt about it has real loyalty in his electorate, and he's got to balance that with farmers who are the core of who's going to vote for him or not vote against, or vote against him, and he's got to weigh that. And I think he made a calculated and correct decision.
So it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, Caesar pointed out that 2020 is a good Lord. Let's hope that there's been resolution this long before it becomes an issue in the presidential, down the road in the presidential race. Bluestein, you got some news for us about an hour from now, something that's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, state officials are in a bind, too, because obviously the state does not have anything close to the budget the federal government has. And the $3 billion or so dollars in this relief fund would wipe out the state's entire rainy day reserves. But you're also seeing Governor Kemp get increasingly frustrated over these delays. And he has much of the same base you're talking about. And agriculture is the state's number one industry. He's going to have a press conference around 3:30 where he's going to talk about some of the damage, some of the things they're looking at. And I've got a quote from him that he's going to say, which is this: "This gridlock exposes the rotten core of some in Congress. They would rather crush an entire industry, destroying the livelihood of countless Americans, than do something that the opposition party wants. This dire situation highlights the brokenness in Washington. We have reached a low point as a nation."
Caesar, that's fascinating. Go ahead.
So this is kind of, how's that show go? This is where we are, or who we are, whatever it is. But, Governor Kemp points out that you've got some folks who have a rotten core in Washington, in Congress. But when you flip it on the other side and go down the street to the White House, you've got a president who's willing to let, millions of people in Puerto Rico suffer because he's mad at the leadership there. The problem, though, and it's so unfortunate, and I hate saying this as a Democrat, is that Democrats stand to lose more than the president, because people know President Trump is going to act like that, and his base doesn't budge one millimeter away from him. And so I think at the end of the day, the question becomes, who's going to capitulate? I really like the fact that Governor Kemp is making a statement, and hopefully that statement will lead to some sort of action on the part of the state to take matters in our own hands to the extent that we can financially.
Tamar, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, so I think about kind of the roots of all of this. Why are we here? And for me, it's kind of a two-track thing. The first one I kind of mentioned in my story in today's paper. You know, the roots of this, you know, the seeds were sown a long time ago. You know, Hurricane Katrina required a ton of money from Congress. People were already, you know, that's when deficits were high. People were already starting to be worried about government spending. Hurricane Sandy in 2012 was a nasty partisan fight that took a long time. And there was a lot of bad blood about, you know, I'm from New York and you Southern Republicans are denying me, you know, and now you're hearing the argument in exactly the reverse. At the same time, you have this new, you know, this new beef with Trump and the House Democrats who, you know, a lot of them will privately say, we see this as a way to stick it to Trump. He needs to know that we're in charge now and we're not just going to take his way or the highway. You know, they feel like they won the government shutdown back in January by being able to hold together and tell him no over and over and over again. And that's exactly what they're trying to do now. But as Caesar said, you know, it is a very risky proposition. And if you're somebody from a state like California or Hawaii that's suffered a lot from natural disasters, how much can you vote no on something like this?
Yeah, you know, Jake, I do think Caesar made a really interesting point. The president has in no way tried to make a rational, intellectual argument for why Puerto Rico shouldn't get more money. He has made it over and over. He's argued and attacked the leaders of the island of Puerto Rico. And yet, as Caesar says, if they lose their whole planting season, then it definitely becomes a big issue for the South Georgia farmers and others down there in the 2020 election. But there's no reason in the world to think that they would abandon their president on this. They'll continue to blame Democrats, yeah. I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the reality is Trump's point is Puerto Rico's already been given a substantial amount of money. We're talking tens of millions, wasn't efficiently used. I think 50 to 60% of the citizens in Puerto Rico are living on food stamps. Obviously, there's difficult situation down there. But his argument is, I'm not going to give more money to a territory which has not shown an inclination to efficiently and properly spend it. There has to be accountability. Obviously, it's gotten personal, but I will tell you, Donald Trump is not a person you want to create personal hostilities with. If you look at the GOP primary for president, every person that went head-to-head with Donald Trump, they ended up losing.
Yeah. Greg Bluestein, so you're going to be reporting. I assume you'll run over to the news, mm-hmm, news right conference. But the governor in this case has limited resources to deal with this, doesn't he? They did during the session allocate some $10 million or so money.
And remember, last year there was also that special session, right, that was a heftier sum. But look, I mean, that's one of the primary roles of federal government is, yeah, helping with disaster relief, and the state feels like the government should chip in, you know, for the brunt of this bill. So there's some loan refinancing. There's some options I'm sure they're looking at, and we might hear a little bit more about that today. But I think they're also going to push for the Perdue-Isaacson compromise because, correct me if I'm wrong, Tamar, but they had $600 million in that bill for Puerto Rico. Yeah, and that would be some sort of middle ground to appease both sides. And it doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere till the summer.
Yeah, Tamar, you pointed out, I mean, Easter recess is upon us. Those farmers are not going to get their crops in the ground without some extraordinary intervention.
Yeah, you start to see some talk, you know, some chatter. Maybe Congress can create some board in Puerto Rico that helps oversee making sure federal money is spent properly. That's some kind of new discussion over the last
few years. Oh, yeah, and that'll happen quickly. They'll resolve that quickly, and then the aid will be on its way in no time.
Yeah, but it's not looking great. I'm already hearing aides who are kind of quietly saying, you know, acknowledging that it might take another really huge natural disaster before Congress gets the kick in the pants it needs to really make a compromise.
And that also shows
kind of sad.
Yeah. And that also shows how quickly the fortunes turned, because Senator Isaacson was right around the corner of the studio, like, what, a couple
just
weeks
told
ago?
Us a few weeks ago when he was in here to do Political Rewind, help is on its way.
I think we
pretty
got
well
it.
Got this worked out.
Yeah.
So it's certainly not for want of trying by either Isaacson or David Perdue. Let's move on. Greg, the governor, you reported a story on Governor Kemp going to Atlanta Rotary, mm-hmm, which is, we colloquially call Downtown Rotary. I bet Caesar Mitchell, you must be a member of Downtown.
I am not.
You're Whoa. Not?
I am not.
Because
yeah,
I was going to say, not. Every corporate leader, most elected, important elected officials are members. I tried to get them to bring me in at one point too, Caesar. They didn't want anything to do with me. So you're not alone. But Kemp went to that group last Monday, I think.
Mm-hmm. And this past Monday, yeah.
Yeah, a week ago Monday.
No,
2 days ago. Thank you. And what did he say about the Hartsfield-Jackson, the proposed state takeover of Hartsfield-Jackson?
Yeah, I was kind of there watching for any heartbeat type news from business leaders because there's a lot of corporate executives, and he was asked about the airport. And he said, well, sometimes we should be thankful that something didn't pass. And I bet Mayor Bottoms wanted him to say that about 2 months ago because he was studiously quiet about that legislation, that airport takeover bill, throughout this entire process, unlike Governor Deal, who quickly came out against it in 2017 and 2018 when it popped up. Governor Kemp was much more arm's-length approach. Well, after the session ends, he says, well, sometimes we should be glad that these types of bills failed. And he also said that this gives Mayor Bottoms and the city more time to sort of vindicate themselves and to show that their transparency efforts at the airport are working.
Caesar, one of the things that Greg reported in his piece about this was the governor said, I understand both sides. Yeah. I think they both have reasonable arguments to make. To me, that really always begs a question. Is that the role of a leader to kind of shrug and say, well, you both make good points? Nathan Deal stepped in immediately when this came up during his tenure. Kemp, in many issues, including this one this session, chose to back away a bit, let legislators hash things out. He stepped in on a couple of very big issues, and this was one of them.
Well, I think if it's an issue that doesn't go to the core of something that's very important to him, I think he's using this first year as an opportunity just to kind of see the lay of the land and to see where everyone's temperature is and kind of see how the initial kind of skirmish down below turns out. You know, who gets the first round, who gets the second round. I think Governor Kemp's calculus, I have no way of knowing this, maybe around the airport, is number one, you know, how is this going to impact economic development in the state of Georgia? And with the looming federal investigation, he's thinking, well, it could go both ways. So maybe I just need to stay out of
it. It may have been the right decision.
Exactly.
Jake, two things on this. Number one, Mayor Bottoms has now she's created a task force, a transparency and ethics task force, going to be headed up by Joe Wilkinson, who was a longtime Atlanta Republican state representative and the head of the Georgia House Ethics
and close to Kemp
committee and very close to Brian Kemp. And I think Mayor Bottoms' position on this is, you know, if we haven't board that can watch the practices out at the airport, contracting, that sort of thing, maybe we can make legislators a little bit more comfortable. At the same time, it's a long time between now and the session in January, and it strikes me that the takeover of the airport could very well be only one indictment away by BJ Pack in this federal investigation that has to do with airport contracts to tipping this in the balance of a state takeover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that was an olive branch in a way for Mayor Bottoms to Governor Kemp. I mean, I think we saw the potential success that the state of Georgia and the city of Atlanta can have under Governor Deal's administration if they work together. Obviously, Mayor Bottoms was actively endorsing and campaigning and assisting Stacey Abrams. I think that hurt Governor Kemp in a lot of ways. And to dovetail from what Caesar said, I think Kemp has been coming in, balancing a lot of dynamics, trying to build up some unity, trying not to take on controversial bills like RFRA. And in addition to that, working and building a relationship with the city of Atlanta, and I think the way that he handled the airport bill, and I'll say that my law firm actually represented the city of Atlanta in that, so the fact it didn't pass is kudos to our lobbying team. I'm not a part of our lobbying team, but I'll put that out there. But
didn't a former mayor used to be a part of that firm, Greg? What was his name? Reed. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go
but
ahead.
But I think that in a way that Mayor Bottoms is prospectively trying to address any concerns around the city of Atlanta, and she's also trying to extend an olive branch to Governor Kemp by putting one of Wilkinson, who is a close colleague and friend of Governor Kemp, in that seat.
The Kemp, if you talk to the Kemp inner circle in December or January, they didn't want this. They weren't a fan of this bill, right? I mean, the people close to Kemp, the governor never said that, but the people close to Kemp were not all that enthusiastic about taking one of their first initiatives, being able to take Atlanta's crown jewels away from it and picking an even bigger fight with the city. But at the same time, if you're Governor Kemp and you're going into your first session as the governor, and a faction in the Senate, a powerful faction in the Georgia Senate, has this as one of their top priorities, you also are reluctant to take it off the table that early, too, for a bargaining reasoning. And then it ended up becoming morphed into this whole Franken bill and ended up scuttling some of his actual priorities, too.
All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break of the show. When we come back, Stacey Abrams is the only woman Georgia Democrat who suddenly found the national spotlight. We'll talk about Abrams and Senator Jen Jordan. This is Political Rewind.
This spring here at GPB, our goal is to cover the cost of the programs you love and hopefully eliminate the spring fund drive. How? Well, instead of cutting into the programs you listen to on GPB like we do during a traditional fund drive, you'll hear short reminders like this one. We're calling it GPB's Stealth Drive. Hi, I'm Tom Barclay, GPB's radio operations manager. People who listen just like you're doing right now provide the single most important and reliable funding for everything you hear on GPB. So right now, we're counting on your support. So while you're thinking about it, call 800-222-4788, 800-222-4788, or donate online at gpb.org. Because public radio matters to you, do it now, and thank you so much.
We're back on Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein, we're still playing a waiting game with Stacey Abrams, who continues, excuse me, to say, maybe I'll run for United States Senate against David Perdue, or hope to win the nomination to run against David Perdue, which is pretty much a given. If she wants it, she's got it. Or should I run for president? And if I run for president, I'll announce in September. Interesting side note, and we'll get into this in more detail on a different show. The 538 just published a piece on how long you can afford to wait to announce for president. And their conclusion was that if Stacey Abrams wants to get into this race, she ought to do it much sooner than September, because of the winners in the past 20 years or more, every one of them announced, with the exception of Bill Clinton, announced 300, 400 days ahead of the election. So we'll talk about that in more detail.
But even for governor, she announced well in advance.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
She filed the paperwork, you know, around this point in that race. So.
All right. The reason I bring that up is that she's registering now in at least one poll. She had not been included in most of the Democratic primary polling, Caesar. But now the Charleston newspaper has done a poll. She's at 7%, which sounds like not much, but it puts her right up there with Pete Buttigieg, who is the big name of the moment.
And that puts her in a mix.
I mean,
most folks are 10 or below. And so for the preponderance of the current candidates to be at 10% or below, and she's at 7%.
She's at 7. Most of them are like 3,
and
2,
she's
Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris.
Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yeah. So she's in a good place.
I mean, I think Abrams is benefiting from what I call the Amazon effect. And if you remember when Amazon was selecting their second headquarters, they were being talked about more based upon where they are going to go, what they are going to do, and it just incites so much interest that I think Abrams is a very, very savvy politician. I mean, she finds a way to be talked about. You look at voter suppression. She worked that narrative. She built that into a national platform. Now with deciding what she's going to do, she's building that. She's getting more free press about that. I mean, she knows what she's doing. I think that one interesting consideration for Tomlinson is Tomlinson, who is
Mayor Tomlinson. Yes.
Mayor Tomlinson of Columbus, is, if I were her, I would have thought about going all in. And because what you do if you go all in is you put pressure on Abrams. And the consideration, and Greg's shaking his head at me, but the consideration of that is, if Abrams then enters the race, you pull out.
Okay, then let's set the table for this, because
sure.
I'm glad you brought it up. Teresa Tomlinson, Just left office as mayor of Columbus. Most of you who listen to this show regularly know that she's been a panelist on this show for the last 4 years with some regularity. Last Friday on our air, she said, yep, I've formed a committee. I'm officially formed an exploratory committee, which means she can raise money and organize a campaign team. But Greg, I said to her when she did the show Friday, I don't have the headline of her news release in front of me, but there's a comma.
Yeah.
It's Teresa Tomlinson is running for Senate, comma, if Stacey Abrams doesn't run. It's sort of, she's really working hard to build a base, but that comma really kind of takes some wind out of her sails, doesn't it?
It does. And the reason why I was shaking my head at Jake is because you talk to Democrats and maybe Caesar will agree. But this is Stacey Abrams' party right now in the state. I mean, if you go against her, even if she's not going to run for Senate, and there's a lot of valid speculation that this presidential rumors is a big sign that she's not going to run for the U.S. Senate, but then she could get in on behalf of one of the opponents rather than staying neutral in the race. But any sort of move that any Democrat makes against Stacey Abrams, she'll never forget. And she's a very shrewd politician, and she controls a lot of the levers of the state party right now. Her allies are in very high positions, and everyone is deferring to her for a reason.
All right, so, but Caesar, you know, I think, take what Jake said, and let's talk about it a little more. I think it'd be hard to pressure Stacey Abrams right now into doing anything she doesn't want to do. At the same time, there are people in the Democratic Party of Georgia who are starting to say, come on, Stacey, we need to hear something from you. The time is getting ripe. And maybe there's a point to what Jake is saying about this sort of pushing Stacey Abrams to say, all right, here's what fine. Teresa Tomlinson's waiting in the wings. Maybe it's time for me to go. Again, Stacey's the head of, she is the party right now.
She's the titular head of the party.
But go with what Jake said and react to it.
Now, so I have a different, slightly different take on it. I think the time is coming, and it's near. If it's not passed, I think the move on the part of Mayor Tomlinson to announce her exploratory committee was a nudge, quite frankly.
Yeah, that's what I think. Jake,
if I were just to make an assumption, I would assume that Mayor Tomlinson and Stacey Abrams have a very good relationship. Number one, and number two, are communicating.
They are.
And so I would think that Teresa's move was one of necessity to make sure she doesn't get too far behind in the process.
Well, she says she really needs to start raising money. She can't keep paying for people out of her pocket.
Exactly. And she's also got to communicate to the public that she's serious about this and really communicate to Stacey at some point.
Okay. Well,
she's serious. But I will say one last thing. I think Stacey's energy and momentum now, if she does not run for U.S. Senate, can be at least to some degree conveyed to a candidate who does. Mm-hmm. I think that's important.
All right, Tamar, Stacey Abrams obviously is in the national spotlight these days. But there's another Georgia Democratic woman who at least seems to be starting to move more into the national spotlight. You covered her yesterday when she testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the invitation, I think, of Senator Feinstein. And that's Senator Jen Jordan, right?
Yeah, and this comes a few weeks after, this speech she gave from the well of the Georgia Senate against this heartbeat bill, the 6-week abortion ban, kind of went viral. And so she really is very much having her moment. Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, called her, asking her to testify against a federal 20-week abortion ban that Senate Republicans are advancing. And she kind of came and gave an abridged version of her speech from the legislature. The hearing, everyone just kind of talked past each other. It wasn't particularly contentious. It was pretty graphic as people kind of told their own stories. But, even she admitted to me after, she didn't think she changed anybody's minds, but it was still pretty cool to be there.
Yeah, it was not, I think, Jake, the most, and Tamar basically said it, it wasn't the best showcase you could want to have if you were Jen Jordan and want national attention. She was one of, I think, 5 women. They were seated one next to the other. Their positions were all very cut and dried, pro or anti, the right of a woman to have an abortion. And so there wasn't much of an opportunity for her to break out and make an impact. But here's what I wonder. Maybe Tamar knows, Jake. I wonder who else she met with while she was up there and what those conversations were like.
Yeah, and
she claimed, and I did ask her flat out, sorry, Jake, I did mention or ask her flat out if she was meeting with Chuck Schumer to talk maybe about a Senate seat. She said that was not in her plans.
And she gave you a pretty open-ended answer when you asked her about her future plans, didn't she?
Yeah, exactly. And she mentioned, you know, if you would have asked me 2 years ago if I was ever going to be in the state legislature, I would have laughed at you. So she made clear she's not closing any doors, but she also mentioned she has two kids under the age of 15. She runs a law firm. She's having fun in her current job. So who knows?
Yeah, Jake, I think Georgia Republicans down at the Capitol have good reason to be a little concerned about what her future might be within state elected politics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jen Jordan to me is a perfect example of why we need more lawyers in the General Assembly. I mean, but really though, she can communicate well. She takes on hard issues. She takes on big issues. And I think long term, she's undoubtedly going to be a force to be reckoned with. Making the transition from a local politician to a state and then particularly a national politician is a tremendous sacrifice. The spotlight and your margin of error decreases at such a significant level. Few people can make that transition and maintain it. But I think she is definitely a topic of discussion down at the Capitol.
And you can see how much she's unnerved Republicans because after some conversations with state officials, I added her to the AJC's running list of potential Senate candidates. And, of course, asked Senator Jordan. She said the same thing, essentially. She said to Marsha, give a very open-ended answer. So I tweeted out something like that, that I added her to the list. And there's a 10, 12 names on the list. And shortly after, Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, who's gone toe-to-toe with her over issues in the Senate over the last year, tweeted out something about the AJC always giving Jen Jordan too much coverage. So they got a little back and forth over that. So you can see where those rivalries, those tensions are starting to form.
All right, we got a lot more I want to talk about. I want to get to a break in a minute, but as long as we're talking about Jen Jordan, her passionate speech against the heartbeat abortion bill, I want to do a quick fact check for those of you who were either listening to our show on the air yesterday or if you were with us in Athens on Monday night. Senator Frank Ginn, we're very happy that he came. So did Bill Cowsert. So did Houston Gaines. It was great to have members of the Georgia General Assembly there. But I do want to make sure that we correct something that a great many of you pointed out to us. At one point, we asked Senator Ginn to talk about HB 481, and he made a couple statements that I do think require a little bit of a correction. One of the things he said was that when he arrived in the Senate 9 years ago, a woman, and this is his quote, could have gone to a doctor in Georgia and had an abortion 30 minutes before delivery. And everybody that was in the audience said, no, there's no way that can happen. I said, that's what the law allowed. In fact, 9 years ago, before Georgia passed the bill that stopped abortions after 20 weeks, when Frank Ginn went into the Senate, an abortion could not be conducted till after 24 weeks, it was forbidden. So he's a little bit off in his timing on that one. You couldn't have an abortion legally in Georgia, say in the third term of the pregnancy. And then he said something that was really controversial, essentially. He talked about something that live birth, essentially, abortions that take place after birth. And what that really means is still a little bit unclear. But he said that it was something that a woman could have in Georgia, and the fetus, if the fetus was born live, there was nothing that could be done to save it. In fact, Georgia law requires that if a fetus is delivered with a heartbeat, the medical intervention is required by law. So I think Frank Ginn meant to represent his position on the abortion bill, but I think we got to correct a couple of the impressions that he left. So just want to do that quickly. All right, let's get our final break of the show out of the way. And we come back, you know, it's really really good to have you here today, Mr. Evans.
Thank you.
Because maybe we can offer you some consolation from a state house race that should have been over months ago and didn't really end until late last night. Mm-hmm. This is Political Rewind.
Sure.
Thanks for listening to GPB, where this spring you'll hear a new innovative way of fundraising on the air. We're calling it GPB Stealth Drive. It's all about giving you more of the programs you come to GPB for and less fundraising. So as you're listening, you won't miss a minute of your favorite shows. But remember, we are public radio, which means your support makes the programs you hear possible. So please do your part now at gpb.org or 800-222-4788. And thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, the role prosecutors have played in contributing to mass incarceration and the new movement of reform-minded prosecutors. We talk with Emily Bazelon, author of the new book Charged, the new movement to transform American prosecution and end mass incarceration. She's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and teaches at Yale Law School. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 right here on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman joins us from Washington, where she's the AJC's Washington correspondent, Greg Bluestein. Greg Bluestein is in the House today. He, of course, writes political news for the AJC. Cesar Mitchell is with us, former president of the Atlanta City Council. And, you know, I gave Jake's law firm a shout-out. We should do with yours, too.
Yeah, we're in the same complex.
That's right. That's
DLA
right.
Piper.
DLA Piper. Wanted to make sure. And Jake Evans, first time. Panelist on the show. Jake, you know, you and Greg Bluestein both sent me a note about this. I send out the day ahead of a show just a rundown to say to you, here's the things, panelists, that I think we ought to talk about, add whatever suggestions you have. And both of you sent me a note because I left an item off, and that was the third election, the third time around for people to vote in House District 28.
That's right.
Dan Gasaway and Chris Irwin, you represented Dan Gasaway, right? First of all, why did we go through? I left it off the note because, frankly, I was bored to tears with the story. Why did it take three elections?
So it was and I was the lead counsel for Representative, now former Representative Dan Gasaway, and it was an absolutely fascinating experience. Back in May, it was May 22nd, 2018, there was the initial primary election between Chris Irwin and Dan Gasaway. There was a 67-vote split. Chris Irwin had the initial edge. Come to find out, the Habersham County Board of Elections and Registration made over 400 district misassignments, and it was concluded that 74 voters were either assigned to House District 28 when they should not have been, or were assigned to a district outside of House District 28 but should have been assigned to House District 28. That ended up going to a full proceeding, and the judge concluded that more votes in the margin of error were illegal or wrongly rejected, ordered a new election. The next go-around, Chris Irwin wins by 2 votes. And one of the voters who was eventually found to be illegal was a female called Patricia Bauer. My client, whenever they were counting provisional ballots, said, no, she's moved out of the district. They proceeded to count her vote anyway. At that point, he decided he was going to contest it a second time.
So let's stop there for a moment. So we should say that you, representing Gasaway, had 2 big victories up until that point.
That's right.
It was only last night that things went south for you.
Yeah, and my representation obviously was limited on the legal side. I did no political consulting. So.
Yeah, Chris Irwin trounced.
3,000 votes plus. It was the deja vu, do-over deja vu. And the voters up there, I went up there for not nearly as long as Jake did, but I went up there for a day to interview voters. And they were, voter fatigue is an understatement. They were frustrated that this had to be taken 3 times. And I know you said you were kind of bored with the story, but it's not. It is a very important issue up there, of course, because there's 50,000 people that didn't have a representative for much of the legislative session. But it's also more than a parochial affair because it became a part of the overall voting rights debate between Abrams and Kemp.
Yes.
And I always found that fascinating. And when Stacey Abrams wanted to run when her Fair Fight group ran an ad on the Super Bowl, who did she spotlight other than a Republican commissioner from that district?
Yeah, Gassaway can be very pleased that his case Jay dealt with helped give ammunition to
I don't think that was the case. He was trying to distance as much as he possibly could.
Yeah. Oh, all right. So I apologize for being flippant because, Greg, you're right. It is, you know, an election is a very important thing. And Tamar, this is something that Stacey Abrams has already used against the way we run elections in this state. But Democrats tomorrow are going to continue using an issue like this. And voters are going to be paying attention to how ephemeral sometimes a voting outcome seemed to be. We never used to think that was the case.
Yeah, but it's proven to be an issue that really animates, especially the Democratic base. And you saw, you know, H.R. 1, the first, you know, the symbolic kind of most important bill, according to Nancy Pelosi, in her new House majority, kind of the first big bill they passed was a big election reform bill that sought to deal with a lot of these issues, not only funding for upgrading voting machines, but also, you know, retooling the Voting Rights Act, kind of bolstering it again, and all sorts of stuff related to elections and voting and fairness and automatic voter registration and stuff. So clearly this is an issue that Democrats feel like they have the upper hand going forward.
All right. Well, we're going to watch how that unfolds. I do think it's interesting that even though Governor Kemp has now signed the bill into law, which establishes that we'll use touch screens with a paper record to vote on in the 2020 election cycle, and even though there have been some other reforms that were added to that measure, the lawsuits against Georgia, Caesar, and the way that Georgia's been handling its elections continue to move forward. Federal Judge Totenberg, still has the opportunity to weigh in on how we're doing our elections. So this issue is far from settled.
It is.
All right. Let me, Tamar, while we've got you up there, let me turn to you about another issue just to start off the conversation again. And it's, we're not going to get into it in much detail today, unfortunately, but just the other day, we received news that two Georgia veterans, in separate incidences in different parts of the state, committed suicide at VA facilities. One at the VA Medical Center in DeKalb County, an enormous facility. The other one out in DeKalb County.
Dublin.
Dublin and DeKalb County. Thank you. Tamar, it becomes an issue of particular relevance for us because Johnny Isaacson is the chair of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and he has for quite a long time talked about and looked at ways to reform the system. We don't know the circumstances of these deaths in their entirety, but we certainly know that veterans have long been frustrated, angry about how hard it is for them to get care. I would think this must have hit Senator Isaacson and his committee really hard.
Yeah, and they were the ones who, I believe, announced the second death in Decatur earlier this week. And, you know, it's one of those tough issues. There's a lot of different interlocking problems. There's the big VA wait time scandal, you know, how long it takes people to actually get appointments, even get to the VA facility. There's a question once they're there, if they're getting the right kind of care, especially if they're getting the mental health counseling that maybe they need. And how do you handle such a huge bureaucracy? I believe it's the second largest federal agency after the Defense Department or somewhere up there, tens of thousands of employees. And it's an issue that's kind of been dogging the VA for the last 10 years. So how do you even begin to tackle it? There was a question a few years ago where VA was appropriated a pot of money from Congress to deal with this issue, and they were barely spending any of it, or they didn't have people in place to deal with it to spend the money. So it's something that Isaacson has promised to deal with. But, you know, at this point, I guess we wait and see.
Caesar, one of the reasons that Johnny Isaacson has gained a reputation for being able to work across the aisle to form partnerships with Democrats is because of Veterans mm-hmm. Affairs. I mean, it's not a partisan issue for the most part. Both parties say we want to do everything we can for the veterans. So in some ways, he does have the ability here to bring Democrats and Republicans together and try to look at some of these problems. But as Tamar says, this is just an overwhelming problem, and to think that veterans are not getting the care they deserve, and some of them decide that they would rather end their lives then continue to have problems beyond just whether they're getting care. It's very troubling.
It's a horrible situation. I think as a country, we should be ashamed. You know, Tamar stated very accurately that if you look at some of the reports that have been done, GAO did a report, and it found that $57,000 out of $6.2 million available was spent on the issue of veterans in distress and suicidal. Yeah. The report also found that leadership has not been assigned, top leadership has not been assigned to even pay attention and apply effort to this issue. So there's a lack of attention, heads are in the sand, and there are no resources going to an issue that is real. Maybe a part of it is that we don't want to admit that we have veterans who serve our country, come back, and are under distress.
Jake?
To me, this is a bipartisan issue. I mean, mental illness is a real problem across the board, particularly for veterans, people who have suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome. They're faced with some of the hardest situations a human being can be faced with. And it's a situation that I think needs to be on the forefront. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's not a sexy issue. It's not an overly political issue. And unfortunately, in our country, if it's not sexy and it's not political, a lot of times people don't talk about it. But I think it needs to be talked about more.
That's a great point. When people lament the lack of bipartisanship in Washington, this is a quiet contrast, and it doesn't get that many headlines. It gets headlines when bad things happen, but that committee has forged some of the most consensus-driven bipartisan legislation in Washington, but it's just a lot of times it's under the radar.
All right, well, we're going to watch to see. It was a sad, sad story. We are just about out of time for today's show. Tamar Hallerman, we always appreciate it when you give us an opportunity to talk to you from Washington. I guess you go on vacation while they're all off on Easter recess, right?
I'll actually be down in Georgia next week, so not vacation.
Well, come and say hello. Tom Faust is waving that you should come in. We'll talk to you about that. Cesar Mitchell, you know we love having you here and hope you come back soon. Jake Evans, first appearance. What did you think? Did you have fun? Did you enjoy it?
It was great. I enjoyed it.
Good conversation.
That's right.
Yeah, you were a good addition to the show. Thanks for being here. Greg Bluestein, obviously, we always love having you here. Thank you. And Greg, by the way, on his way over to the governor's office to hear what the governor has to say about how the state might help with relief for the farmers in South Georgia. He'll be posting that, no doubt, in the Political Insider blog, and I'll bet you there'll be a story with his byline on it in the paper tomorrow morning. Before we leave you, a couple of quick notes. First of all, again, thank you so much for all of you who turned out in Athens to see us. We had a big crowd. You were really enthusiastic, and we loved having you. Also, a big thanks to WUGA, the public station in Athens. Jimmy Sanders and his team did a great job helping us prepare to get that show on the air. Finally, I want to tell you, Friday we have a very different Political Rewind for you. Right now at the Alliance Theater in Midtown Atlanta, two strong, wonderful female writers, Pearl Clegg, novelist and playwright, and Faith Saley, a commentator on CBS Sunday Morning, and many of you hear her on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, are going to come in. We're going to talk a little about the works they have on each stage at the Alliance, but we're going to also talk about women in society today with Faith and Pearl and Jim Galloway. See you then.